What is up, everyone? Welcome in, welcome in. Happy Thursday, July the 24th. It is 5 p.m. Eastern, a little bit after 5 p.m. Eastern. We're a few minutes late getting fired up here. We'll give everyone a chance to jump up on stage. Apologies for the little delay getting open here. We were finishing up a great conversation over on Stocks on Spaces. We had some really good information coming out that spilled over the top of the hour just a little bit, but do appreciate everyone's patience as we get moved over and ready for this conversation. And boy, I'm excited for this one. Each and every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern here on Wolf Financial, we talk venture capital and private investing. We have angel investors on here, founders, all kinds of VCs, different things around the space. And we hit a lot of great topics. And of course, as always, I have my co-host here, Mr. Self-Taught Success himself. Jared, how are you, my friend? Want to turn it over to you to get us kicked off.
Hey, thanks, Emp. Appreciate it. Excited to get into our show. We have a show based on nuclear energy today. About maybe 2 months ago, we had a show on this on the energy topic as well, and then it led into the nuclear energy conversation. And the feedback we got on that show was the best feedback we've gotten on any show we've had, just as far as the amount of messages I got and what the messages said. So we said, hey, let's do it again. So we got some good guests back here and excited to dive into the show and talk about energy, nuclear energy, how that relates to AI, how that relates to really every industry. And also, of course, we'll tie it into venture capital and private equity. So I'm your host. My name's Jared. Go by Self-Taught Success on here. And basically what that means is all the information you're looking for is out there. It's just up to you to find it. And once you find it, learn from it and apply it on paths or goals. And so that's kind of the goal of what I do with my brand and with the show here, is to bring that information right to you. My co-host Kyle is out this week. He's working on making deals, but excited to dive in here. So I want to pass it to the panelists here, Mark and Stefan, if you guys want to come off mute and give yourself a quick intro, who you are and what you do, that would be awesome.
Hey, Stefan, why don't you go first? I'm actually super curious to hear about you because although I've seen you on Twitter and you make smart posts, we've never met.
Yeah, of course, appreciate the kind words, Mark. So I'm active duty military, and in the military, I've been operating reactors for about 15 years in the submarine community. I got really interested in the public side of nuclear as things started to pick up pace near the end of last year. And I kind of saw an air gap between kind of like public stock coverage of nuclear companies and like actual sensible things being said about them. So I found a place to kind of insert some common sense and try to ask the right questions and, try to come up with some more realistic timelines and projections for people. And I think so far people are picking up what I'm putting down, which has been good so far. So just trying to get involved and get information out there to try to help investors make informed decisions as opposed to, going off of some of the more uninformed hawkish stuff that you can find out there sometimes.
Wait, so you're saying you're now a professional hater because you actually drive nuclear reactors?
Sam, I'm a professional what?
Sorry, just let me fill in for everybody that now that there's been a big wave of support for nuclear energy, it used to be that if you were like somebody who actually operated nuclear reactors, you were in a world of hurt, and everybody else was trying to tell you that what you were doing is wrong and nuclear is bad and you had to explain. Now, a lot of the people who operate nuclear reactors are finding themselves sometimes accused of being anti-nuclear because their views, which are informed by actually running nuclear reactors, are contrary to some of the most extreme pro-nuclear sentiment that you hear either about the nuclear market or about nuclear startups. So just making a joke about that, Stefan. I see a lot of people with incredible experience being torn down as nuclear haters because although they love nuclear and have operated it, people who are new to the space have reasons to complain about their realistic points of view.
No, I couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah, adding realism to some of the timelines or, commercialization within 60 days and some crazy other statements that I made out there and trying to provide some reasonableness definitely invites some backlash more often than not.
Awesome. Love, right, love so the I'll little introduce myself. Mark. Yeah, Mark, go for it.
Sure. I'm trained as a nuclear engineer, but I feel inadequate with Stefan on the panel who actually runs nuclear submarines. I was never in the U.S. Navy. I'm just a yapper by my standards of what the real engineers in the field are like. Where I have more experience is that I went from nuclear engineering school into a world that had no nuclear engineers in it for a long time, or maybe ever. And that was NGOs that worked on climate and clean energy. So I was helping advise them on how to save nuclear plants from being closed. And it turns out it does help to have some expertise in nuclear and to be able to defend nuclear plants on a technical basis and economic basis against really well-funded environmental NGOs that were trying to shut down our most important nuclear plants here in the U.S. and around the world. So in 2015, I went out to California, 2016 rather, went out to California and worked with a series of environmental groups on saving nuclear plants from closure. Now a lot of the money that was backing those environmental groups to close nuclear have switched around and they love nuclear now because we don't have enough steady power to expand AI as quickly as we could if we had kept nuclear plants open or had started building 10 years ago. So I have my own consultancy, Radiant Energy Group, and we advise industry leaders and startups on strategy and technology issues in the nuclear world.
Well, that's very cool to hear you say that, Mark. And maybe that can be a perfect lead into my first question that I wanted to bring up today with the consulting you do, but also yourself being a nuclear engineer. The data that I looked at says in America, there are only roughly 13,400 nuclear engineers, which is not very many. And when you think about how many Americans there are and how many people have jobs, and 13,400 is not very much. Like if you grow up in a town of 13,400, you probably know everybody. And so what does that look like as far as companies trying to hire the top talent? In the past weeks, I think the last couple weeks on the show, we talked about kind of the space race in AI as far as Sam Altman, Zuckerberg, and Tim Cook, all those guys kind of competing, as well as Elon, as far as, you know, paying people $300 million to try and attract top talent. So with such a limited supply of that top talent of nuclear engineers, how are companies able to get that? And what separates them? What kind of offers are they making? I'm sure they're not making, you know, offers like suck, but how are they able to get that talent and what does that look like?
Well, this is going to be an interesting episode. This is some inside baseball stuff, and I don't think I've ever talked about this stuff publicly. One of the things that's happening now is that people with no particular experience are so excited about nuclear that straight out of school, they want to work at a nuclear startup. They want to do anything that can let them move fast. I don't want to say bright things because that just doesn't apply as much in nuclear. But the race for talent is partly that people want to be in nuclear so much that if you're competing against the legacy firms with starting engineering salaries of anywhere from, you know, $75,000 a year to $130,000 maybe, I don't know if I've heard anything really higher than that. It's not that hard for a startup to offer some equity, a reasonable pay package, and to be able to get people along. I guess it's sort of embarrassing. I guess in a perfect world, you'd be having, you know, giant public poaching battles for key nuclear engineering talent. But yeah, it doesn't quite work like that. The executives in even the biggest nuclear companies are not like making immense amounts. You'd have to be at a huge utility near the top to be making anywhere near the sort of sums that we see mid to mid lower level software engineers make. So nuclear has not been where you go to get super rich for a long time. I've heard of people who 10, 20 years ago started nuclear companies, aggressively expanded by being entrepreneurial, and might be worth a couple hundred million today or a billion. There's also mom and pop engineering services firms for nuclear plants where if there are people, they're starting to try to roll those up, but it's just been a good lifestyle. They probably made a fortune of 10, 20 million and make a few hundred K a year. This has just not been an extremely expensive and desperate rat race for talent. We do see some poaching of traditional nuclear company experts and executives to go to some of the best funded startups. But this is a sort of once in a generation surge of venture capital money and incredibly high valuations for some companies that, even if they're working on cool stuff, have never deployed a reactor before, have never serviced a reactor before, have never handled a reactor before. And if their valuations allow them to hire expensive people, well, they're going for it, but it has not been a severe talent race.
That's cool to hear you say. You know, you haven't talked about that publicly, but I do think on this show, that's something that people are interested in. Real quick, I want to ask the audience, if you click that purple button at the bottom of your space here, go ahead, give this space a retweet, give it a like, give it a comment. Let's get it out to more people. We have 70 people in the room right now listening. It'd be awesome if we could get that over 100. So real quick, go ahead, give that a retweet, give it a comment, and let's get some more people in here. And with that, I want to introduce Samuel. If you want to introduce yourself real quick, who you are, your connection to the space, and then if you want to carry on to that that question that I just posed there as far as how are you able to get such top talent? What does that look like? I know you've kind of gone through that with the hiring process, but with such a limited amount, I think 13,400 is the number that I saw as far as nuclear engineers in the country. What does that look like as far as actually getting that talent on board?
Yeah, thank you, Jared. And hey, everybody, this is Sam Gibson with Hadron Energy. And I'm currently walking in downtown New York, so I'm a little bit out of pocket where I usually am, but excited to be here. And really great question, because I just ran a similar search of how many nuclear engineers are there in the U.S., and you're spot on. It was around 15,000 for what I saw. And to that point, you know, the talent is really limited. And I think that's partially due to the fact that industry has not really seen as much growth as it should. And I think now, with this new acceptance and the market demand, there is a lot of young talent that I think are really entering the field at this time. But as Mark was saying, there's really not a lot of individuals who have that operating experience of actually operating or building a plant, for example. So in that regard, that kind of talent is very, very limited. But I think the desire to be a nuclear engineer is actually quite high. You know, it's, I think, a very mission-driven type career where, yeah, you might not get incredibly rich, but it's very fulfilling. I think it's something that's really important. And with Hadron specifically, we've actually been doing pretty good in terms of recruiting, bringing in industry veterans that are just really excited of, you know, trying to start something new. Hadron just passed its 1-year anniversary. And I think at this stage, we have 24 people. So at that point, like, recruiting honestly isn't that big of a challenge if you have that solid base of, I'd say, key hires in the beginning. And everything kind of just builds upon the founding team, really. So as long as you have a solid, like, founding team, I think recruiting efforts are, they just build upon that. So we've been seeing some good growth and excited to be here. So thank you.
Hey, can I just comment on something that I think is urgent, and I just don't think I've heard many people say publicly before? When I told one of my old engineering professors, I was in aerospace and mechanical engineering as an undergrad, I said, hey, I discovered nuclear, I'm going to switch to nuclear, and I'm going to try to save it. This old professor looked at me, chuckles, and says, just what nuclear needs, another damn nuclear engineer, and then laughed at me. And I'm like, hold up. And he says, all of your professors here, us old guys, we were the stars. We were the nuclear engineers, and we all left because of non-nuclear problems in the nuclear space. So in one way, we need nuclear plants that can be built and run by non-nuclear people. We also have this huge bottleneck in people that can be hard asses and organize successfully large, complicated projects. Even a bunch of small reactors are going to be a large, complicated project if you need a bunch of them, right? So we there's such a short bench in people who have claimed to manage a nuclear construction project in the West. There's almost none of them. And most nuclear plants that are being built now, well, guess what? That talent is employed by entities controlled by, say, the Chinese government or the Russian government. Although it would be possible to hire the best Russian nuclear plant talent, you'd have to convince them that they could smuggle their family out of Moscow and make more money in the West. Like, there's a very short bench of really talented, successful, veteran nuclear plant builders in the West. We're needing to recruit people from other mega projects to help see if we can combine that with nuclear expertise to get plants done. We also are needing to pick over whatever worked right, whoever was really good at high levels of the few recent success stories in nuclear construction in the West. And success by our standards does not look like success in the Chinese or Russian standard. It means you actually finished building and somehow got it done. It doesn't mean you did it on time and on budget. Or it may mean that by the time you got to it, it was already messed up and you didn't let it get worse. So putting those people together in a team backed by big capital, with a clear road in front of them, that may be what we need. The other approach is saying that if we start from changing the design, we may be able to fix legacy issues by an inside-out approach from the reactor core onwards and make things work. But one of the first things that happens when some of these startups get really serious, and Sam, I don't know if this is what you're planning, but one of the first things that happens when you get a bunch of millions and you get a lot of design work done is then you go to the old legacy engineering firms with super deep knowledge, and they charge you by the hour to help you design the plant around your device and to look over what you've done. These are also the firms that get hired to do due diligence for big banks on these startups. And those big traditional firms are really the repositories of a lot of the nuclear engineering talent, and they don't pay particularly high salaries. It's just the way it's been in nuclear. Hopefully that's interesting to some of the people on this space.
Yeah, no, I love to hear that. And I always just think it's interesting how companies come to those decisions and what they look for. So I appreciate you sharing that, all that, Mark. I do want to jump over here to our next topic. Have a bunch of different things I want to get to, but before I do that, just a follow-up, quick one for you, Mark. You mentioned, the United States kind of looking outside for different talents. The recent MOU with, I believe, Saudi Arabia, part of that mentioned outsourcing U.S. talent for nuclear work. So do you think there is still that, top level talent that can be outsourced, or do you think, part of that MOU is just words written on paper, but it ends up being, more outsourcing, or, in Sam's case, shipping out products to other countries? What's kind of your take on that and ties with the MOU?
So there's a bunch of laws in place that limit how nuclear engineering technologies and expertise can be shared with countries that do not have an agreement with America not to proliferate. That is above and beyond what the IAEA actually requires, or what the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty requires. The requirement, that special requirement for countries to jump through a bunch of hoops and sign what's potentially an embarrassing or emasculating agreement with America is called a 123 agreement because of section 123 of the Atomic Energy Act from back in 1954. So what this order basically means is the administration wants to work with Saudi Arabia without necessarily having to force Saudi Arabia to sign an agreement that they've been very resistant to sign in the past. Other Gulf states have gotten nuclear while signing this. So for example, the UAE signed the 123 agreement with America that said, we pinky swear, we promise to never proliferate. In fact, UAE wanted to make it so clear what their intentions were, they gave up way more rights than they actually needed to under the non-proliferation treaty's obligations. And they wanted to absolutely without any suspicion. And they then built a company in the UAE that was able to draw on a huge amount of American talent and expertise left over from our boom years in the 80s and 70s, 80s, and then 90s, if you include the final units we commissioned and put into operation. Some really senior people, instead of retiring, went and they used all of their lifetime knowledge of building nuclear plants in the U.S. to help out that project. I know a number of these senior advisors, and they're very energetic people in their 70s, and I really like learning from them. But yeah, that's some of the advice that they are then legally allowed to give if we have a 123 agreement in place. And it sounds like we're going to try to get closer to helping Saudi Arabia with nuclear instead of just forcing them straight in the arms of China or Russia, the other countries that just say, if you follow international law, that's fine by us. We're not going to make you sign some special agreement with a Congress in order to sell you reactors. Does any of that help?
No, I think that makes great sense. And I think that's, you know, the best answer you could look for there. I'm sure if you type that into ChatGPT, you wouldn't learn all that. So maybe you are the ChatGPT for nuclear energy. So that's great to hear. I want to jump to the next topic. If you look at the top of the space, I have it pinned. It's actually comes from one of our panelists, and I'll just give you brief overview on it, but basically public nuclear energy companies are up an average of 122% in the last roughly 90 to 100 days. So how do you view this as that's the public companies? How do you view that for private companies? Does that encourage insiders to want to go public so they can get liquidity? Because as we know, private equity shares are a lot less liquid than public shares. And then do you think that growth over those last roughly 90 to 100 days, which timeline lines up very close with the three different executive orders that President Trump signed, do you think this is a honeymoon phase, or is this jump something that is sustainable now that the administration has changed? Do you think the tides have changed more long term? So, Stefan, I'll open it up to you first because it's your tweet. But then, Sam, I also feel like you probably have some unique point of view and perspective on this. So I'd love to get your guys' thoughts on that.
Yeah, I definitely think we're in a bit of a honeymoon phase. I definitely would agree to that. I've been tracking for a while the performance of the nuclear companies that are publicly traded. I don't I've never offered buy or sell, mostly because of the severe speculation with a lot of the names, especially the reactor developers that don't really have a dime to show for their work yet. But I do think there is motivation to make the transition from private to public. And we've seen that with Terrestrial Energy going public and Terra Innovatum also going public as well. There was also even news this morning of, Deep Isolation is now going through the process as well. They're going to list on the over-the-counter markets probably within the next few months here. They'll be tradable. So I do think that we're going to see a lot more development coming in that direction, because I think people are very obviously motivated by the euphoria that we've seen, not even in just the last 90 days, but I mean, in the last year almost now, with some of these names up over 10 times what their previous values were, especially the reactor developers like Oklo and NuScale. And it's obviously almost impossible to assign a solid number to them because they aren't really generating any revenue. We have, guesses that are based on, dozens and dozens of assumptions for what their reactor designs are going to cost, the timeline that it's going to take to actually construct them, what the final agreements are going to be with the off-takers. There's an endless number of assumptions that's being made right now. So it's very, very difficult to make valuation models off of those. And so it's very speculative, and I do cover them, and I do post about their gains every once in a while, but I do try to pretty routinely remind people that there is risk definitely with a lot of these names. I do kind of lean towards more favorable opinions of the industrial companies, the tickers that you'll see at the top portion of that chart up there in the picture. And that's mostly because they're long-term companies that have some pretty significant cash flow, some of them in the billions of revenue per year to support their designs. And I do think they're much more well situated to capitalize on some of the things that are incoming. in particular, a lot of the companies that are in the supply and fuel chain, as opposed to the reactor developers, which are going to be more competitive with each other. I do think there's a lot of industrials that have found their niche. And I do think they're pretty well entrenched with where they are to enjoy some pretty serious revenue gains should the nuclear renaissance continue the way that it is.
That's a lot of great insight there. Definitely appreciate that. Sam, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for those insights. And I can tell you from my perspective, Hadron is a microreactor developer. We're building light water micromodular reactors. And of course, what you see in the markets is definitely interesting. I think NuScale with receiving their standard design approval is quite the big achievement, but obviously there's still more work to be done. So at this stage, I think most of it is sentiment and how you project these financial projections. At the end of the day, it really comes down to the ability to raise capital for the decision to go public, I think. And there's pros and cons to being a public company, obviously, with increased reporting and earnings calls and, you know, all these targets you have to hit. And you always have to please the public as well, which maybe could take a strain on what you really should be focusing on. And maybe that's more research and development and things like that. So I think there's pros and cons to both. It just comes down to the ability of these companies to raise funds, and whichever avenue makes the most sense, you know, for these companies to do so is what they should probably do. But I argue for you know, the common sense approach, and the way that we want to do it at Hadron is we want to raise our funds privately and then, you know, build our demonstration unit, get it licensed, and then maybe consider going public or doing something like that down the line. Whereas where we are today, it doesn't seem very feasible, you know, where some of these other companies are, to be trading publicly when they don't have a lot to show. So that's kind of how I feel about the situation. I think it's very positive for the industry. So I hope, you know, the momentum continues.
Sam, you talk about momentum. I know earlier on the space, or just in his last answer, Stefan mentioned it and Mark mentioned it earlier, but this is an industry that's a little different than, you know, some of the other industries we talk about on the show. Sometimes we're talking about, you know, different tech startups, whether it's a SaaS where, you know, you can launch your SaaS and you can see money tomorrow. You can be profitable on day one. Nuclear energy is a very capital intensive business. It takes a long time to see profit, takes a long time to see any money coming in. And just kind of wanted to get the panelists' thoughts on that. And Sam, I know you've been through a couple different fundraising rounds. So when you're talking to investors, maybe from Sam's perspective, but for the other panelists, just overall, what would you see from the investor side? What are some of the conversations like as far as timetable, time duration, for investors, just because it is such a capital intensive business and it does take a lot of money to get things going to the point where you could be profitable at some day. What's that process like and conversation like with investors?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And really what it comes down to is this is such a niche area that there's actually pretty limited, like, large institutional investors, to be totally honest, given that exact reason. They want to see that return on capital in a timely manner. So what I would say is the most feasible is going to these infrastructure, energy funds, those with, like, longer mindsets, because traditionally you talk about venture capital, for example, they might have a shorter, you know, time to exit that they want to see, like 5 years, for example. And in this case, nuclear is such a long-term investment that it has to attract very patient capital. So that's what I would say. And that subset of investors is fairly limited, although it does exist. And I think the opportunity is there. So it's just a matter of finding those right partners.
Awesome. Mark, Stefan, do you guys want to chime in on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the timelines are extremely tough, and I'm sure it's really hard for some of the bigger players to come in, because I'm sure just like you were referencing earlier, some of these firms will use, or I think it was Mark was talking about earlier, some of the investment firms will refer to more experienced companies to do some kind of evaluation to say, hey, what's the feasibility of this design and such. But as we know, like there's not some huge pool of people that have built a bunch of SMRs and, have, solid graphs on, construction headaches and cost overruns and an idea of how long this is going to take. So I'm sure that, there's definitely some hesitation for people to throw money into something they don't really have the ability to understand. And there's no pool of people out there to help them understand. I'm sure that's going to be frustrating on that side and involve some hesitation. But I think especially with the timelines, there was for a long time, there was discussion of that the timelines were all so long and unpredictable because of the NRC. And, at the opinion of some of the developers that the NRC was going to be the long leg, the long pole in the tent for getting the project approved. And, we don't know what they're going to implement and what they're going to require of us. And I do think that that has been a significantly reduced concern in terms of the timeline for getting a reactor from concept to commercialization. I think a lot of stuff has been done recently for reducing. Some of the multi-year timelines are now no longer than 18 months. Some of the requirements, some of the portions of NEPA, are probably also going to be significantly reduced here in the coming months as well. So I think people are now kind of moving on from how long is the engineering, is the licensing side of it going to take? Now it's a question of, what does your fuel supply look like? What does your, parts and equipment side look like? What do you guys have, things in place for getting your pressure vessel forged? Do you guys have things in place for securing uranium from some mine in Canada or something like that? So I think there's going to be a change of pace in the questions that are asked. Before it was the regulations, and now it's going to be more so on the supply chain.
I'll just say that you don't need patient capital if a bunch of SPACs are going to happen and stocks always go up and stuff like that. So we may see a weird moment of nuclear. I don't know if supercharge is the right word, but a lot of money coming into nuclear that might not go if they had to be patient to get their capital back. That's on the private side. And on the public side, there's so much excitement for nuclear and so much pent up need for its power that there may be an enthusiasm that can outpace potentially the ability of nuclear to expand fast enough. But hey, if people love a thing, then they can keep supporting it by betting on it for a long time. And I don't give investment advice. I've been as astonished as a lot of insiders, I think, at the rise of a lot of nuclear technology company stocks.
Well, that would add right in line with the 120% gain we've seen over the roughly last 100 days across nuclear energy companies. But people can buy stocks, and most people who buy stocks don't really know what they're buying or really anything about the company or how the company makes money or how much money they're buying stocks based on. Buddy said this is the next Steve Madden, and he talked to Jordan Belfort and he said, buy the stock kind of thing.
Well, there's something else happening, which is if a stock gets big enough, index funds have to buy it.
Yeah. Once you get into that crowd, but a lot of times that's a pretty big stake. So are there very many of those companies in the nuclear industry that are big enough for that?
Well, let me put it this way. Constellation is now what, nearly $100 billion market cap company. It did not exist 3 or 4 years ago, and it only got started because it was spun off as a high risk, money losing part of a regulated mom and pop widows and orphans utility company stock. So that was pretty crazy. I know that one of the other large cap or larger cap large by the standards of nuclear companies is a company like Cameco, which was a, you know, $7 a share, and now up to 80 just in the time that I've known him. That's pretty amazing. And that's not because those are meme stocks per se, but it is partly based on the recognition, sudden recognition across many governments, left-wing political parties, energy modeling groups, utilities, et cetera, that nuclear has a very specific, very high value role to play in an AI boom, but also because I think the public enjoys the idea of helping nuclear win. So I'm definitely a proponent of the theory that a lot of the stock market is entertainment. And I don't think that that's always a bad thing that may be true. If the public likes a thing, they can allocate capital and bet that others are going to also, and that may be a reason for the current boom.
That's a good explanation. We are at the 15-minute mark here, so I do want to ask the audience, go ahead, give our speakers a follow. They post a lot of informational content about the industry all the time, so give them a follow. Click their profile, hit the follow button so you can stay up to date with all the stuff they're posting. Again, we got about 15 minutes left here and excited to keep it going. Mark, just listening to you there and talking about some of those companies, one of them, Oklo, I believe $9.1 billion market cap right now. And if I'm correct, I don't even think they have quite the licensing they need. And so earlier in the show, Mark, you mentioned crazy balloon valuations that are just super, super high. And we've talked already about, you know, companies not actually making money or not generating revenue, let alone profit. So how do these companies, obviously publicly traded companies, it's pretty simple, but private companies, how do you guys come up with the valuations when you're going to raise funds in this industry? What are the things are you looking at? Are you comparing to public companies? Sam, I think that'd be you have some unique perspective that'd probably be good on that.
Yeah, I can add my two cents there. So when I was mentioning earlier patient capital, that's exactly what I was meaning as far as seeing these nuclear companies actually earn money, because that definitely is going to require patience for it to be a profitable venture. Right now, it's more of like we were kind of talking about there is it's kind of just investing with a sentiment, and that's totally fine. And I think it's great because the industry definitely needs to see investments, and I fully support it. So when it comes down to the valuations, it's honestly mostly based on future financial prospects. And, you know, companies can develop all the MOUs they want and things like this. But at the end of the day, what it comes down to is what are customers going to pay for these reactors or for power purchase agreements or things like that. And you can model based upon these agreements what a company could be worth when it generates this type of revenue. So I believe that there's tremendous potential for these companies, and ultimately it's going to come down to how strong the offtake agreements are. So that's what I'm seeing, and I think you can model the valuations based on that.
Awesome. That definitely provides some good context there.
And I just want to say that I know the folks at some of the folks at Oklo, very smart people. There's an enormous pent-up demand for nuclear energy, and I think their stock price represents that to some effect. I think that there, if we're looking at licensing, as it becomes clear that there are multiple paths to getting reactors licensed or built or tested, specific stages at the NRC are going to be less important. And I hope that that relieves some of the, I think, completely misdirected, misguided attacks on the NRC by some of the folks in the startup world, which I just want to say for the record, I think it's a very bad thing for nuclear that they're doing that. I think Stefan was excellent when he talked about all the things the NRC is doing a lot faster. They're responding that to that demand, but that's not at all the same thing as saying the NRC shouldn't exist or shouldn't regulate. And it certainly is not true that the NRC has been the thing slowing down nuclear substantially. There's been very little demand to build nuclear. And in that case, the NRC could even take 18 months and still move faster than the nuclear companies themselves could develop their technology. So I think that Oklo had some bad experiences with NRC, but is definitely feeling more comfortable and confident with the with various ways to license reactors. And they, I don't think, support the attacks on the NRC that we've seen from other parties, even though they themselves had an issue with the NRC in earlier years. And hey, we'll see what happens. There's a lot of reactor testing left to do. We've uncorked a lot of bottlenecks in the fuel supply chain. That should not be a limitation in the future. And it's now prove it or shove it time. I guess it's put up or shut up time for a lot of the nuclear reactor startups.
Go for it, Sam.
Yeah, I just wanted to piggyback off of what Mark was saying. I definitely agree and don't approve of the other sort of companies attacking the NRC because it doesn't look very good at all. And what we need is an NRC that's focused on things moving in the right direction. I think they're actually doing a very good job, especially with the accelerated timelines. I was at the NRC in person a couple, or actually it was just last week, and the week before that, talking about microreactor specific licensing, for example, and they were going over how all these new frameworks they are developing are going to really unlock this industry in terms of the deployment timeline. So as Mark was mentioning, it's definitely up to you know, the industry to now bring their A game and actually start deploying these projects. So there's a lot of positive progress, but I just wanted to share that I don't support those companies that are attacking the NRC because I don't think it really does much of any good. So I thought that was a good point.
Awesome. Appreciate that, Stefan. Do you want to hop in here real quick?
Yeah, I do think that I think the focus, like I said earlier, is now that the NRC complaints, I think we'll start to die off here as the focus now shifts to, you know, companies putting their money where their mouth is, so that they have to be just as quick as the NRC is if the NRC is going to move as fast as these timelines are scaled out for. And I do think a lot of that focus is going to shift to the supply chain, like I alluded to earlier. And I think some venture capital is going to find its way there as well. And I think a great example was Standard Nuclear buying up the fuel business from UltraSafe Nuclear Corp when they went bankrupt last fall. Standard Nuclear came in with a couple other investment firms and started purchasing a fuel manufacturer for one of the niche fuel designs that's going to be used by some of the reactor developers today. So that's just one of the examples of, you know, private money finding its way into other parts of nuclear that are, you know, definitely underdeveloped. I think enrichment is another huge underdevelopment as well. I think it's pretty well understood at this point that the U.S. is extremely behind with domestic enrichment. Almost all of our enrichment right now comes from either overseas or foreign-owned companies that have operations here in the United States. So there is one public one, you know, one of the biggest gainers that I'm tracking right now is Centrus Energy. You know, they're getting there. They're starting to produce HALEU domestically, you know, at a commercial scale. They're trying to expand actively. They're trying to start up their low enriched uranium as well. It's trying to get there. But in terms of, you know, enrichment and conversion, mining, milling, all the stages of the fuel chain are definitely really, really far behind in terms of reaching commercial scale to support a build out in the United States. So I do think some private investments are going to find their way there as, you know, the reactor developer, the end user starts to get a little bloated and a little bit of a crowded trade, you could say. So I think some people are going to start looking further up the supply chain for investment opportunity.
There's a lot to unpack there. I had a couple thoughts come to mind just from my limited knowledge on nuclear. So Sam, Mark, I'm sure you had a lot of wheels turning based on everything that Stefan just said there. Go ahead, hop in.
Yeah, so the fuel historically is, you know, something that's considered to be a bottleneck, and I think a lot of things are spinning up right now, which is great. You need the uranium extraction, you get the ore, then you have the conversion, enrichment, and the fabrication to fuel pellets of, you know, what you're going to be designing for. So I think it's something that's really coming around. We have some great partners domestically, and I really hope that this does scale up. I did want to mention, I actually have to jump to a meeting here in person that I've got going on. So I wanted to thank you all and keep up the great discussion. And I look forward to connecting with you after the call.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks, Sam. Real quick, everybody in the audience, go give Sam and the rest of our panelists a follow. They post a lot of good content all the time. So stay up to date with what they're working on and their latest projects. One more thing I want to hop to, unless Mark, you wanted to chime in on anything, but maybe I'll just pass this next topic to you. And then you can add on if you would like. And I just pinned it here in the top of the space, but if you scroll, you'll see it's actually a tweet from Mark, but Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, they announced huge data centers. I think if you're familiar with the space at all, you know data centers are a huge part of the future. With AI, how is AI powered? Well, it takes energy. Jensen Huang from NVIDIA was talking yesterday at the big AI event, mentioning how AI infrastructure is critical to really any energy, and energy is critical to AI infrastructure in any new industry, and how that's going to be a huge factor. We know that right now, depending on where you're getting your information, maybe around 2% of global energy is consumed by AI. And in a few years, about 5 years from now, it'll be at least probably around 12%. So maybe that doesn't sound like a big number, but it's a big number. And so I just kind of wanted to get your guys' thoughts on, you know, how does the AI infrastructure with the data centers impact nuclear energy? How does that impact, you know, just the world and the energy market in general? But also these data centers, once they get built, Zuck is not having his $300 million new engineer go and build that structure. So that's going to be contracted work. That's going to be a lot of businesses working to build those data centers. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on what kind of ripple effect that has for job creation and other small businesses.
Well, so nuclear has been underappreciated by big tech until very recently, and now big tech appreciates nuclear very much and says we like it now. And what's available now is buying up power from existing nuclear plants. It raises a host of issues, but one of the things it does is it reveals the power of nuclear electricity. So there are nuclear plants in the U.S. that shut down over the last decade because they couldn't secure electricity contracts at $50 or $60 a megawatt hour. Meanwhile, big tech is now willing to pay $80, $90, or even $100 a megawatt hour to get nuclear electricity. So that is a massive change in valuation of nuclear electricity. Why do they want nuclear electricity? Because it's a huge amount of highly reliable power from a specific location. They may be buying giant blocks of power and then distributing their data centers around the grid and then paying the grid for the service of delivering it wherever it's needed. And other people have to make up the specifics on location, but they've paid their share because they bought out the nuclear power. There's also going to be increasing amounts of improving the transmission between nuclear plants and then coupling these nuclear plants together and putting data centers in between on the lines. I think we're going to see that in Illinois. That tweet that you posted from me is basically Facebook paying about $90 a megawatt hour to buy out 20 years of electricity from these nearly immortal nuclear plants. This is really important because Constellation has said over and over that they are not going to build new nuclear until their old nuclear is all contracted out at high rates. I think that's fair, and it's something that that draws a target on the map for the price that's going to be needed and the type of commitments from big tech to justify building new nuclear plants. So just wanted to add a little bit of context for people on that tweet.
That's awesome. I appreciate that context. Stefan, do you want to add anything there?
I think Mark pretty well covered it. I do think that it creates the long-term incentive. Obviously, new nuclear is not going to provide power to any data centers tomorrow. It's most likely to be supplied by gas or something else in the meantime. But I do think, just like Mark was saying, it does, like, the interest in nuclear power is back, and the obvious signs are there, especially since the first big deal was announced last fall with Microsoft and Constellation, and ever since then it's just been a phenomenal roller coaster of good news that everybody
in the space definitely enjoyed. Don't forget Amazon and Susquehanna before that. It's just weren't expanding capacity there; they were just buying up existing.
Right, and that one, if I'm tracking correctly, that one is still incurring some headaches with, I think it's FERC, right? The conversation is somewhat ongoing with that one.
Well, I just talked about this at some length in a couple podcasts I recorded today that'll come out in a few days. But basically, the data center is located next to the facility. And that proximity was being used to claim that therefore it was behind the meter and Amazon shouldn't have to pay the 10 to 15% extra for the grid services. This was a cheeky argument and it's basically been slapped down. So although it's more expensive than they expected, even after getting this ruling, Amazon more than doubled the size of their purchase from the plant. So it must not have been bad enough, Stefan.
Very cool. I really appreciate the color on that because it's been hidden behind some of the details. So I appreciate the clarification.
One last question before we go. Quick 30 seconds from each of our panelists. What is one thing you would like the audience to know about nuclear energy, whether it's something that's controversial that you want to push back against, or whether it's just some educational piece or something to go do homework on? 30 seconds, one last thing about nuclear energy you want to leave the audience with.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and start. The supply chain is not there yet. There are there's a long list of engineering headaches that are yet to come. We don't even know all the headaches that we need to find yet. And I do think that there's more pain out there, but I'm definitely confident in the ingenuity of the engineers that we have today to overcome them. But I do think that there are headaches on the horizon that we haven't been able to discuss yet. And I also think that people are going to see that all along that the delays were not the regulatory side, but the actual hard, construction and actually splitting atoms, I think, is going to create more headaches than people anticipated. I'm very bullish on the long term, but in the short term, I think there's going to be some pain.
I want to say that nuclear is almost certainly required for Europe, but we actually have to get it right for it to get built in America, where we at the moment have so much cheap gas and a lot of decarbonization policies that can just be rolled back in a panic and people can suddenly invest in expanding nuclear or coal plant output. So the imperative is not as severe in America as it is for Europe, but we also have a more business-friendly environment and nearly unanimous political agreement to get nuclear built. And we're going to see states push very hard to make sure it happens. Already, energy prices in the Northeast of America that has traditionally been more anti-nuclear are so high that Democratic state and local leadership in New England and New York are pushing really hard to get nuclear built. And they're going to have to come together, multiple states in a coalition, to get major capacity added. I think we're going to see that. Because nuclear plants are effectively immortal once you build them, it tends to encourage long-term thinkers eventually to figure that out and come together and get it done. And I hope we're going to see nuclear plant starts before the end of the decade, even in areas of the country that have traditionally been anti-nuclear or hard to build in.
Awesome. Love getting to learn more about the industry. I always think our spaces on nuclear, the two that we've had, have been really good. So we'll have to do it again. And I appreciate everybody for joining us. If you're not already, go give our speakers a follow. Click their profile. Give them a follow. They supported us coming on the show. Support them. Show them some love back. And stay up to date with what they're doing and continue to learn about the industry. We are back every week, every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern, talking venture capital and private equity, different topics. They range from the crypto side, the Web3 side, the traditional side, AI, bunch of different startups, energy, and every anything you can think of. And so every Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern, we're talking venture capital, private equity with a bunch of different people. If you have questions, feel free to send me a DM or somebody you think would be good as a speaker. I'd be happy to have a conversation with them. And that would be great. And with that, I want to say thank you, everybody, for joining our show. And I'll pass it to Emp and let him finish it out.
Oops, sorry, could not get unmuted there for a second. What a great show, great hour. I learned a lot about nuclear. To be honest, it's been such a hot theme in the market. I'm super appreciative of this panel taking a deep dive into it. So it's something I need to continue studying on, but boy, this was a good launching point on that. Big shout out to Jared for co-hosting up here. Make sure you follow him. Does a lot of great work both on and off this platform. We appreciate the audience and the whole crew. And we'll be back live trading first thing in the morning over on Wolf Trading. Got several spaces lined up for tomorrow. And of course, you can see our full schedule right there on the homepage of Wolf Financial. It's our pinned tweet each and every week. Thanks, everyone. Have a great rest of your Thursday, afternoon, evening, night, wherever you're at in the world. We appreciate you tuning in. Take care, everyone.